Okay, thank you, Peter. Thank you for inviting me to talk here, and thank you to everyone for hosting me for the last 2 weeks or so. It's been a really nice day here. Okay, so the title of my talk is Electric Fields and Quantum Wormholes. This is work that I've done in collaboration with Dalit Engelhardt, who is a student who's normally at UCLA, but she's visiting Amsterdam for 6 months or so, and Ben Freivogel. I think everyone knows who he is. He's faculty at Amsterdam. And so the title of my talk includes a really fancy word, quantum wormhole. So you shouldn't get too excited. It's actually something fairly mundane, but I'll explain what I mean by quantum wormhole. And I think everyone already knows what electric field is. Okay. So what am I going to talk about? So as I think everyone here knows, it's becoming increasingly clear that entanglement and geometry are related in some sort of profound, maybe deep way. And so everyone knows what entanglement is, but let me just orient us by just briefly giving the canonical example of an entangled state. If you have a quantum state, so for two different spins, okay, then you can prepare a state where the two spins are entangled. So you take one of them up, one of them down, and then add it to the other one down, other one up. And now these two spins are correlated in some sort of way, okay? And we call this an entangled state between the two spins. So the interesting thing about this, of course, is that at least I find it somewhat hard to visualize what this this particular correlation is not too hard. But in general, when you have more complicated states that are entangled, I find it a bit hard to visualize classically what this information is really encoding, what entanglement is really encoding. It's something that seems fundamentally quantum mechanical. And what's really interesting is that in certain cases, even though entanglement is a very quantum mechanical thing, there are situations when you can visualize it very simply and very classically. And so the most precise connection between entanglement and geometry has happened somewhat recently in the context of ADS-CFT. So again, I think everyone probably knows what's on this slide, but let me just review. Take some quantum field theory, say a conformal field theory, and consider a spatial region A in that conformal field theory. Okay? Now, given this field theory in some particular state, you can trace out everything that's not in this region A and get a reduced density matrix, rho sub A. You can then compute the ordinary von Neumann entropy of that density matrix, and you get the entanglement entropy of A with everything else. Now, the really remarkable thing is that this is some sort of complicated, ugly observable, but if this field theory has a nice gravity dual, then it's actually very easy to calculate this entanglement entropy from the gravity dual. What you do is, this region now lives on the boundary of a higher dimensional ADS space, and you find a bulk minimal surface that hangs down into the bulk and ends on the boundary of A. The area of this minimal surface is supposed to compute the entanglement entropy of A. And so this was first conjectured by Ryu and Takinagi some time ago. And since then, there's been a lot of work on this. By now, there's a proof of this. And we think it's actually true in more general. There's a more general, so the proof is only in a particular setting, but we think it's true very generally. And there is thus a precise sense in which in ADS-CFT, entanglement in the dual field theory is dual to geometry in the bulk gravitational theory. So this is a very precise thing at this point. However, in the rest of this talk, I am actually not going to be talking anymore about ADS-CFT. So everyone can simply forget about ADS-CFT. From now on, I'm going to be discussing things that are sort of all happening in what would have been the bulk on this side of the picture. Okay? Okay, so everyone forget about ADS-CFT. And now I want to talk about something else. Recently, a sort of interesting and stronger statement has been made, okay, by Maldesen and Susskind. So what is their statement exactly? Or what is my reading of their statement exactly? Before I state what they discussed, let me first talk about something that I think most people are familiar with again. Consider the following object. Think about the eternal, asymptotically flat Schwarzschild black hole. This is a very standard solution to general relativity. The Penrose diagram looks like this. It has two asymptotically flat regions. Okay, so we have asymptotically flat space here and flat space here. And they're connected in the middle by a horizon, or rather by two horizons. Each of these sides has a horizon, and they're connected in the middle. Now, if you look, for example, at this space-like slice, this line right here, it looks like this. Okay, there's one asymptotically flat region. The S2 shrinks to a very small size, but not zero. It shrinks to the horizon size, and then it expands again on the other side. So this is the topology of this particular space-like slice. Now, it has two sides. You can call this a wormhole. So when I talk about wormholes for the rest of this talk, this is what I'm going to talk about. It's a wormhole that connects two sides. But it's kind of not that practical of one because, for example, you cannot use it to travel from one side to the other. If you go into this side, you can't get out the other side. You can meet your friend if he has coordinated with you previously to meet in the middle, but that's what this wormhole is good for. Yeah.
Can you remind us what kind of GR solution is that?
This one?
Yeah.
Or is it just normal vacuum GR?
Okay.
This is just the maximum extended Schwarzschild solution.
So just add it up another way.
Exactly, yes. So this is the maximum extended Schwarzschild solution. Yeah. Okay, good. Other questions? So this is the maximally extended Schwarzschild solution. It's a solution to vacuum gravity. All right. So this is of course this is a thing called an Einstein-Rosen bridge. Normally, the bridge connecting these two sides is called the Einstein-Rosen bridge. Okay. Now I want to point out something. This is a solution that connects two totally different universes through a black hole. But it should be clear that you don't need these two wormhole mouths to live in two completely disjoint universes. You can also imagine them living in the same universe, but having the two ends very, very, very far apart. In that case, this is no longer an exact solution, but it becomes a very, very good solution as you take the two wormhole mouths far apart. This doesn't make a lot of difference for the physics, but it's sort of linguistically very useful to imagine just having the two black holes here. So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to imagine an Einstein-Rosen bridge connecting two black holes that live in our universe that are just very widely separated. Okay? Okay. So this is the eternal black hole. Now I want to compare this to an object which seems completely different. So here's the Einstein-Rosen bridge connecting two black hole horizons. I want to compare this to the following object. Take in our universe, take two electrons, okay, and prepare them in an entangled state, and then separate them by a very large distance. Okay? So these two objects seem completely different because one of them is two black holes, one of them is two electrons. They're obviously very different things. But there's some sort of structural similarity between them in that there's a connection between the two black hole horizons and there's some kind of connection between these two spins. You cannot send information from one side of this to the other. You cannot use entanglement to actually send a message from one of the spins to the other. That's just how entanglement works. There's some sort of structural similarity between these two things, but nonetheless, it seems obvious that they're very different. But nevertheless, about 2 years ago, Maldacena and Susskind, they were motivated by considerations from black hole information, which I think Suvra told us about a couple of days ago, but I'm not going to review them because I don't have anything to say about them. But they were motivated by considerations of black hole information, and what they said is that in a theory of dynamical quantum gravity, so in a theory where these electrons interact with gravity, these two objects are somehow the same. There's some connection between these two objects, some link. And you should think about them as representing the same physics. In fact, what they really say is that if you have ordinary perturbative quanta in our own universe that is entangled, then you should think about this perturbative quanta, these ordinary electrons, as being connected by some sort of very small, Planckian, crazy, quantum fluctuating Einstein-Rosen bridge, or a quantum wormhole. So this is what they said in this paper. Okay? And this lends itself to this wonderful slogan, because, ER, this is an Einstein-Rosen bridge, it's ER, and this is an EPR pair, so you can say ER equals EPR. And it's a cute slogan, okay? Okay, so this is the statement that they made in this paper. Now, of course, you could ask what this really means, because if you think about it, I have not really said anything with this slide, right? Because really, what I'm just saying is this is just a definition of a quantum wormhole. So from now on, this will be my definition of quantum wormhole. Take any entangled state of ordinary perturbative matter, okay, in two spatially separated lumps with a great deal of entanglement between one and the other. I'm going to call this a quantum wormhole from now on. So I told you it would be mundane, okay? But this is the word, this is what I'm saying is the definition of a quantum wormhole. Okay, fine. But you see, now really the question is, are quantum wormholes, do they deserve this name? Are they anything like classical wormholes? Okay? This is what we should try to answer. Because maybe they're just nothing like classical wormholes, in which case it's just a stupid definition. Okay? Okay, so the question I really want to ask is, what good is a quantum wormhole? What can I do with it? So really, what we should actually ask is, what good are classical wormholes? What can you actually do with those? Because they're not actually obviously good for that much, right? So what good is a classical wormhole? Like I said, you cannot actually travel from one side to the other. So what good is a classical wormhole? What can you do with one of them? Well, if you think about it, there's actually one very basic thing that you can do with a classical wormhole. A classical wormhole obviously changes the topology of space. There used to be an S2 that would shrink to zero size. Now it doesn't. The topology is different. It's non-trivial. And what that means is that you can send an electric field through a classical wormhole. This is obviously a very clear thing. Electric field lines don't end because of Gauss's law. So you would naively think to send an E-field through, you need to have this sort of geometric connection. And in fact, if you think about it, an E-field is sort of a very, very crude way to probe geometry. So to back up and go to an even simpler setting, imagine a parallel plate capacitor. Okay? There's some space in between the two plates. You can attach a battery to the two sides, okay, and create a potential difference 2 mu. If you do that, it's clear that electric field lines will come out from this end and go to this end. And the electric field that you get depends on the separation between the two plates. As you make them further and further apart, the electric field goes down. So in some very crude way, if you can apply a battery and measure the electric field, you are probing the geometry in some sort of very crude way. So for much of this talk, I'm going to explain what it means to send an electric field through a classical wormhole. And then the question I really want to answer is, can we send an electric field through a quantum wormhole? Okay? Does the electric field see the quantum wormhole the same way as it sees the classical wormhole? And this is a question which should have a well-defined answer within low energy effective field theory, because I'm only looking at ordinary perturbative matter. Okay? I can call it a Planckian Einstein-Rosen bridge, but it really has a perfectly good description in terms of low energy QFT. So there should be a precise answer to this question. And that's what I'm going to tell you towards the end of the talk. OK. So any questions at this point? OK, good. So this ends my motivation section. So next, I'm going to talk about electric fields and classical wormholes at some length. I'm going to discuss it classically. And also, I'm going to discuss the quantum theory on the black hole background. And then I'm going to move on to the quantum wormhole and discuss what happens there. And I'll conclude with some things that I think are interesting and some future work that can be done. OK. So here we go. So first, electric fields and classical wormholes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So in this talk, I'm not going to treat metric collections very strongly. But if you think about it, they are actually important just in a weakly coupled way. Because the matter carries energy. The energy, you know, it fluctuates. And so it does source the metric. But you can treat it within a perturbative, sort of perturbative gravity about flat space. So it's weakly coupled, but still fluctuations are important. Yeah, but they're weak fluctuations. So, and in the very end, I'm going to discuss how, I'm going to talk about basically just E and M, but at the very end, I'll discuss how you can generalize to gravity. And over there, the fact that gravity, you know, the low energy effective field theory of gravity coupled to quantum matter will play a role at the very end. But not till there. And it still remains completely controllable because I'm only discussing things at low energies. And of course, we have low energy quantum gravity is fine, right? If you have low energy fluctuating things, that's totally fine. So I will use that theory at the very end. But for most of this talk, I'm not going to talk about it at all. Yeah. But you see as I go on that everything I'm going to say is about E and M. It's structurally quite similar to gravity because, I mean, at low energies, there's not a huge amount of difference. Gravity has more polarizations, but it's, you know, the constraint structure, the Gauss's laws and things like that behave very similarly. So I think it'll be more clear as I go on. But yeah. But for most of this talk, I'm just going to talk about electromagnetism. But yeah, it applies to gravity without much modification, actually. Okay. Good. Other questions? Okay. Okay, good. So first, electric fields and classical wormholes. Okay, so first I want to spend some time and make sure we understand exactly what it means when I say that I can pass an electric field through a classical wormhole. Okay, what exactly do I mean by that statement? It sounds sort of obviously true, but I want to explain exactly what this means in great detail. OK, so I'm going to study the canonical classical wormhole. It's a solution to this action. OK, so I have an Einstein-Hilbert term. I have a Maxwell term. I want to note that the Maxwell term has a gauge coupling, a U1 bulk gauge coupling, which I'm going to call GF. This will play an important role in what follows. But everything is weakly coupled, so you should imagine that GF is very, very small. And so now, if I first turn off the Maxwell term completely, we have the usual eternal black hole Schwarzschild solution. It's a solution to vacuum GR. This is the metric on each side. So for R greater than RH, we have this. The same solution applies on this side. And then you have to patch them together in a sort of conventional way that's done in textbooks. So the Penrose diagram looks like this. This is the metric. And again, this particular space-like slice looks like this. Okay. So this is what I'm going to study for the first part. Okay. So now I want to pass an electric field through this. So imagine that I have these two horizons. Let me put these two horizons in this room. So say I have the left horizon here and the right horizon here. going to call this the left one and this the right one. Now, surround each of these horizons with a sphere of radius A, okay, where A is greater than the radius of the horizon. I can now define the electric flux through each of these spheres. So I'm going to call phi L the flux through the left sphere and phi R the flux through the right sphere. And the electric flux is, of course, defined in the usual way. I'm just integrating the electric field over the area of each of these S2s, phi left and phi right. I'm choosing to normalize it with a factor of 1 over GF squared. This is for later convenience, but I just want to point this out. That is a factor of the gauge coupling appearing in my definition of the flux. Okay, so this is a very standard thing. I have some flux through this horizon and some flux through this horizon, and they're connected in the middle. Okay, so now I want to point out an interesting fact about these fluxes. It is convenient to form two linear combinations of these fluxes. So consider phi sigma, which is phi left plus phi right. What does phi sigma do? Phi sigma, of course, by Gauss's law, is just the total flux out of the wormhole. So it actually just measures the number of charged particles inside, because you can reduce it via Gauss's law to counting the number of charges. That's what phi sigma measures. Now, if you think about it, that means a couple of things. For example, it's actually hard to change. Where when I say hard, what I mean is, for example, with the action I put on the previous slide, I actually cannot change phi sigma because I had no charged matter in that action. It was just Einstein-Maxwell. So for example, if I'm working with that action, phi sigma is actually set to 0. So it's difficult to change. I can add particles, of course, to the action, and then if I had some charged matter, then I can change it. But you know, it's still hard because I have to make a whole charged particle. It'll probably cost some energy to make this charged particle. It's difficult to change. Related to that, it appears that it's quantized, right? In a quantum theory, I'll have one charged particle, two charged particles, three charged particles in here. Phi sigma appears to be quantized on this background. And this is clearly related to the fact that it's hard to change. I have to create one entire particle, which carries one quantum of charge. OK, that's phi sigma. Let me now talk about phi delta. Phi delta is the difference in the right flux and the left flux. What does phi delta measure? So phi delta measures the electric flux through the wormhole. It is actually not hard to change, right? It's easy to change, because it's an E-field line that goes straight through. There's nothing preventing me from throwing one or two more E-field lines into this black hole. I don't need to have charged matter to create an extra E-field line going through here. Related to that, it seems like it's continuously tunable. There is no obvious quantization condition on the electric flux through the wormhole. In particular, if I hold parameters fixed and if I mess with various things characterizing this, I expect the electric flux through the wormhole to continuously change. There's no simple quantization condition. If you think about it, the difference between these two things clearly happened because the geometry is connected. Okay? The fact is there exists geometry between these two sides, which is what made it possible for me to pass an E-field through and create this continuously tunable phi delta. Let me now do a little computation to illustrate exactly what I mean by continuously tunable. Consider taking your black hole and attaching a battery to the two ends. Okay? How much E-field flux do you get through here? So by the way, I just want to state that actually I'm saying consider taking and attaching a battery. In reality, you can't actually attach a battery to the black hole. It won't work because it won't be in equilibrium. So really, this state has to be given to you by God, but the state exists. And so from now on, I'm just going to say consider doing this, you consider doing this. I don't really mean that you can go home and do it. I just mean that the state exists in the Hilbert space and you can consider that state. Okay? Yeah, exactly. So you take this black hole, attach the battery, nothing will happen because the two boundaries, exactly, as you said, space like separated. But the state exists, and we can discuss how you could make it in quantum gravity if you want. But the state exists. Okay. So now consider taking a battery and attaching it across the black hole. Okay. Now the battery has potential difference 2 mu. I now want to compute the flux through here as a function of the battery. I want to compute the capacitance of the Einstein-Rosen capacitor. So how do I do this? This is a really easy calculation. All you want to do is do the same thing you did with the normal parallel plate capacitor, which is you want to solve Maxwell's equations in the interior of the black hole with the boundary conditions that the potential on the left side is minus mu and the potential on the right side is plus mu. Okay? So this is a completely well-posed boundary problem. You can solve it. What you find is this for the electric flux through the system. Let me just say how it's easy to see this is correct. You know the flux is proportional to mu. You also know that it's dimensionless. The only other thing in the problem with dimensions is the horizon. So RH must appear here to soak up these dimensions. The factor of 1 over GF squared is there just because I put it in there in the definition to begin with. Okay? So this is the flux through the black hole as a function of mu. You can see what I mean about it being continuously tunable, because mu is a tunable parameter. You can adjust this, and phi changes continuously. There's no evidence of any sort of discreteness here. Okay, so this statement is true, but of course I'm just doing classical physics, and you might worry that if you do the actual quantum problem, maybe it's not, maybe this is some artifact of the classical limit, maybe this fact that I'm really harping on the fact that this is tunable, maybe it's not a precise statement at the quantum level. So actually, the fact that this is tunable is a manifestation of a precise property of the quantum wave function. So let me now talk about the quantum wave function of this system. So I'm now going to talk not about classical E&M on the black hole background, but the full quantum theory of E&M on the black hole background, which is still totally fine because it's just quantum field theory on a black hole, and we know how to do that. Okay. So I'm also going to be studying compact E&M, okay, which means that the electric flux through a non-trivial S2 has a discrete spectrum. I'm studying compact E&M because there are good reasons to think that whenever you have dynamical gravity, you should always have compact gauge fields. But I'm not going to get into that. Just for now, let's just assume that we're studying compact E&M, which means that the flux, which is now an operator, the flux operator has a spectrum which is discrete. Okay, so now you should be a little bit upset, because I just made a big deal out of the fact that the flux through the wormhole is a continuously tunable thing. But on the other hand, the flux operator in the quantum theory is a discrete spectrum. So what do I mean? You know, why did I make a big deal out of this? What am I saying? So let's study this in more detail. So first, what is the precise quantum state of the Maxwell field on the black hole background? I want to study the state which is in thermal equilibrium, which means I'm studying the Hartle-Hawking state. Okay? The Hartle-Hawking state is, of course, very well studied. If you break the Hartle-Hawking state into fields on the left and fields on the right, then it takes the following thermofield form. Okay? So if I have a left Hilbert space and a right Hilbert space, the Hartle-Hawking state looks like this. Okay? It's a sum over all of the energy eigenstates on the left side and all eigenstates on the right side. Okay? The sum is weighted by a factor of the energy, where this energy is measured with respect to Schwarzschild time. Schwarzschild time runs like this and like this on the two sides. And this is the exponential energy factor which appears when you write down the Hartle-Hawking state. Okay? And there's a factor of CPT acting on the left side. This factor CPT is often omitted, but it's actually quite important. The way to see that it's there, one way to see that it's there, is to look back at how the Hartle-Hawking state is actually defined. It's normally defined in terms of a Euclidean path integral. Now, a Euclidean path integral tells you how to go from an in-state to an out-state. But on the other hand, this is two sort of in-states. They're not in and out. Therefore, I have to go somehow from an out-state to an in-state, and CPT is what does that. So this factor CPT is actually there, and you'll see it's actually very intuitive in this particular example. Okay, so this is the Hartle-Hawking state. Are there any questions about the Hartle-Hawking state? It's familiar to people? Okay, so this is just the normal state of the quantum field on this black hole background. Okay. Now what does CPT actually do? CPT flips the sign of the flux because of the C part of the CPT. But it leaves the energy invariant. Okay? So if I look at a particular state in this sum, it's labeled by a bunch of quantum numbers. The flux is a conserved quantity, so I can simultaneously diagonalize the flux and the energy. And now if I have a state here with a particular energy and a particular flux, the corresponding state will have the same energy, but the opposite sign for the flux. Okay? And that's how all these states will be paired in this Hartle-Hawking state. So now let me act on this with these phi sigma and phi delta operators. What do they do? Well, if you first act with phi sigma, you can see that phi sigma is phi left plus phi right. So it's going to bring down a minus phi and bring down a plus phi in every term in the sum. They will add and cancel. And so every term in the sum is annihilated by phi sigma. And so phi sigma precisely annihilates the Hartle-Hawking state. On the other hand, phi delta doesn't, because phi delta brings down phi left and phi right with opposite signs, and so they combine to add. So when you act with phi delta on the Hartle-Hawking state, you just get some other random state. Okay? It is not annihilated by phi delta. It is annihilated by phi sigma. Okay? So the flux operators have a very different action on this state. So if you think about it, what this means is the CP, what the CPT is doing for you is the fact that phi sigma annihilates it means that phi left on this state is always equal to phi right on this state, which means that the flux lines go smoothly through here. So CPT is doing something that makes a lot of sense for you in this particular case. Okay? Okay. So that's what's happening with phi sigma and phi delta. So what this means is that the Hartle-Hawking state is not an eigenstate of the electric flux through the wormhole. If you plot the wave function as a function of phi sigma and phi delta, it is, has support only on 0 for phi sigma and has spread in phi delta. So this sort of simple intuitive picture you had for the fact that flux can go through the wormhole, but phi sigma is fixed to 0, that intuitive difference is actually can be traced back to this wave function. So we see it means something even in the quantum level. So since I'm saying this spread is important, it's now very natural to compute the spread of this wave function. So I'm going to define an object called the wormhole susceptibility, which is the VEV of phi delta squared. So the spread of this wave function in the phi delta direction. I'm going to call this object chi delta. I'm going to call it the wormhole susceptibility. Okay? It measures how easy it is to put electric flux through the wormhole. Are there any questions about this definition? So now, let me now return to the chemical potential in the quantum theory. So let me now again attach the battery, but I treat this quantum mechanically and not classically. Attaching the battery actually corresponds to deforming the Hartle-Hawking state in a very particular way. It corresponds to adding this term minus mu phi to this Hartle-Hawking state. Okay? So now, in the presence of this term mu, this mu phi term, my state is deformed and now depends on mu. I now want to ask, what is the VEV of phi delta on this deformed state? So to lowest order in mu, I can do linear response. I can just sort of expand this in powers of mu and bring down a couple of powers of the flux operator into this thing here. If you work it out, the first leading term is a term of phi delta squared evaluated on the undeformed state. This is familiar from linear response. And so you get a factor of chi delta here multiplying beta and mu. And so you can see that this illustrates what I wanted to say, that as you turn on a battery, the amount of flux you get through depends on the spread of the quantum wave function in that direction. So this should seem very intuitive, because really all I'm saying is this wave, this electric field is sort of wiggly. If you deform mu, if you change mu a little bit, then the wave function shifts a little bit, but the amount that it shifts depends on how wiggly the wave function was in that direction. Okay? So phi delta of mu is equal to chi delta times beta mu. Now, of course, we've already done this computation in the classical theory. So we can compare this to the answer we got previously and read off the answer for chi delta. If you compare this to the previous answer I put for the flux through the wormhole, you find that chi delta is 1 over gf squared. Okay? This, of course, depends on all kinds of normalizations. But the normalization that I chose, chi delta is 1 over gf squared. And you can see that this wormhole susceptibility is non-zero, really because these two sides are connected. Okay? That's what caused the spread in this wave function. So this is chi delta for the Einstein-Rosen bridge. It's very, very, very large because the coupling is very small. Okay? So to get this, I sort of did a little bit of quantum stuff, but then I appealed to the classical answer we had previously. Something else that you can do is try to study the full wave function. Okay? So let me just discuss that briefly. Yeah?
So what's here specific to the wormhole? Because just take normal, you know, flat space.
You
to imaginary, you know.
No. It's not specific to the wormhole. It turns out it is harder to calculate in flat space with two things, but it's not specific to the wormhole. It's the same thing. It's the same idea. You can calculate the flux through an empty region of flat space, and you get some answer, and that answer is the capacitance of that region of space. That's all the same. The kinematics is slightly different because the way I defined it sort of includes a factor of beta in it, so the kinematics is slightly different, but the physics is the same. Okay, it's because I chose a definition that includes a factor of beta in here for later convenience, but the idea is the same. Take a region of flat space, compute the fluctuation of electric flux, you get some non-zero answer, and it does roughly tell you the capacitance of that region. Okay? It's exactly the same. It is easier to calculate for the black hole than it is in flat space. But that's just the peculiarity of this. Yeah, so it's all the same. Okay? Good. Other questions? Okay. Yeah, you don't need the wormhole for this. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so in any case, we calculated this susceptibility. Now, let me just be a little bit more explicit about this, because you see, I talked about this wave function. I didn't actually compute the full wave function yet. Let me just tell you how you can compute the full wave function. So this can be done very explicitly. And what you should do is you should quantize the flux sector of Maxwell electromagnetism on the black hole background. And this can be done because the S2 never shrinks, so the flux through this non-shrinkable S2 is a quantum degree of freedom that is a quantum mechanical Hamiltonian describing it. And so you can work out that Hamiltonian, and let me just briefly discuss how this works. What you do is you write down the action with respect to Schwarzschild time, so time that runs like this, and then you integrate over the S2 to get an effective Hamiltonian with respect to Schwarzschild time that just measures the fluctuations of the flux through the black hole. So you can get an effective Hamiltonian for this side and for this side, and then you can use these Hamiltonians and plug them into the formula for the wave function, for the Hartle-Hawking state, and actually work out the precise wave function for the thermal field state. And what you get is just this, okay? You get a Gaussian with the spread given by this thing that I calculated previously, okay? And this is a very easy quantum mechanics problem. It shouldn't surprise you that it's Gaussian because I'm just working with a free theory, so everything should have been a Gaussian, and the spread is exactly what you expect to be in this limit. So basically, all the point to take away from this is that if the wave function is extended in the phi delta direction, that is the quantum manifestation of what it means to be able to pass an E field through a region of space. Okay? So, is there any questions about this?
What's the kinetic term?
In this thing?
Yeah.
So the Hamiltonian for the flux sector does not have a kinetic term. This is the full thing. Because if you think about it, what I'm trying to say here, it's just the total, do you want to know, there is an operator which is conjugate to phi. That operator is the Wilson line that goes through the black hole. That's the thing that raises the energy. But the Hamiltonian doesn't care about that. The Hamiltonian only measures the energy cost of the flux, right? So you can explicitly diagonalize the Hamiltonian in this sector. It's diagonal in the flux sector. Does that make sense? Or yeah, OK, we can talk about this. But yeah, but it's just measuring, it's just telling the total, it really is just the energy of the total field, right? The energy of the zero mode of the field, OK? Good. So yeah, that's why it's so easy to quantize. You can just write this down immediately, OK? OK, good. Other questions? OK. OK, so this was a long discussion about how electric fields go through classical wormholes. So now I want to ask the same question for a quantum wormhole, where a quantum wormhole was defined as I did previously, just some normal entangled matter, okay? So first, let me now turn off gravity, okay? And just take two ordinary boxes in flat space. I have a Maxwell field living in these two boxes, okay? And now I want to ask the precise same question. I can again compute the flux through one box and the flux through the other box and compute phi L and phi R. And now I can ask, can I pass an electric field through this quantum wormhole? So first, I'm just doing it with the Maxwell field. So can I do this? Well, if you think about it, if I just have this Maxwell field present, then this is actually very simple and kind of boring, because now the topology is trivial, and so the flux through each of these boxes must actually be exactly zero because of Gauss's law. So let me just review this. I have div E equals to zero in the interior. I can integrate that up all the way to the boundary and conclude that the flux is actually zero as an operator equation on every physical state. There's no subtlety because of any non-trivial topology. The flux through both of these spheres is actually exactly zero. Okay? So it doesn't matter what you do, you can entangle them as much as you like, you can put as big of a battery as you want. There is no way to get an electric field to go through this particular set of entangled matter. Okay? This is a useless quantum wormhole. It doesn't even let me pass an electric field through it. Okay? Okay. So I could stop here, but let me go on. Let's try a little bit harder, okay? The problem was that there was no way to get any flux at all. So let me now add some charged matter to the system, okay? So now it's a little bit more interesting, right? Because now I can have fluctuations of charged matter in these two boxes, and the flux is no longer zero anymore, okay? So what is the flux doing now? Now Gauss's law looks like this. I have div E equals to rho, where rho is the charge density of this charged matter. And so now if I integrate this up, what I conclude is the flux through the left sphere is equal to the charge in the left sphere, and through the right sphere is just the charge in the right sphere. Okay? So they're no longer zero. But on the other hand, it seems like there's not a great deal of difference between phi sigma and phi delta. Each of these fluxes just measure the number of particles in the appropriate sphere. So I can form these two linear combinations, phi sigma and phi delta, But it just seems like they both just count the number of particles in this particular combination. And so there's not a great deal of difference. So it does not look like I can actually pass an E field through this system. Okay? But let me press on. So let's do exactly the same thing we did for the black hole. Let's attach a battery between the two sides in the thermofield state and tune the battery and then measure the flux through here minus the flux through there. Okay? So what happens? So doing exactly what I did previously, I take now the thermofield state, except the Hamiltonian in the thermofield state is now the ordinary flat space Hamiltonian of the charged matter in the two boxes. And I attach the battery in exactly the same way. Okay? So now I have a lot of states in this sum. Let me look at a particular state in the scalar field sector of this sum. Okay, so what's actually happening? Well, first of all, because of Gauss's law, the flux is equal to the charge. So the global charge of the scalar field state. So I can replace the flux with the global charge of the scalar field state. Each state in this sum has a global charge, which is flipped by CPT. Okay? So again, I have a minus sign here and a plus sign here. And so what's happening is, of course, that the scalar field on this side feels a chemical potential plus mu, whereas the scalar field on this side feels a chemical potential minus mu. That's what this means right here. Okay? So now, given this state, I can now just do the exact same computation and just compute the flux here minus the flux there. Okay? So I want to compute, again, the flux through on this deformed thermofield state. Okay. Now the flux is phi left minus phi right. As I've emphasized, that's equal to the charge, Q right minus Q left. Or sorry, Q, okay, I'm switching signs, but it's Q right minus Q left. Now, this is actually a sum of two things which are localized on the two sides. It is a sum of two one-sided things. That means that to compute the right side, I can just trace out the left side. When I do the trace in a thermofield state, what I get on the other side is just the thermal density matrix with respect to that side, except that now it'll be the thermal density matrix at finite chemical potential. So this is a very easy QFT computation now. You can sum over all of the states in the thermal state with a non-zero chemical potential, and you get some answer which is non-zero for the right side, and you get the same answer with the opposite sign for the left side. Okay? And therefore, they combine to give you some non-trivial function of all the parameters that you can compute by doing normal QFT, multiplied by some factors of Q squared and a linear term in mu. So what this means is, if I turn on an arbitrarily small mu, the flux through, which I've defined in the following way, is actually not zero. Okay? You actually get a flux that goes through the system. And so the wormhole susceptibility for this EPR state, so for this quantum wormhole, actually is not zero. Defined in the following way, you can pass an electric field through this quantum wormhole. Okay, so okay, but what just happened? Okay? What am I saying? What I argued is, if you attach a battery to these two sides, it looks like an electric field goes through, but of course it doesn't really go through. What's happening is an electric field is trying to enter here. It tries to enter and it tries to create a charge. But because the two states are entangled, if I create a positive charge here, I'll create an exactly equal negative charge there, and it'll spit out the exact same E field. Now, when I say it's the exact same E field, you know, I mean in this particular sense that the E field is correlated, but this is qualitatively the same as having an E field that goes all the way through. If you were measuring this from the outside, you could not tell the difference between this setup and this setup. It looks like the electric field lines penetrate straight through without ending. So I think it is fair to say that the entanglement has actually tricked this gauge field into thinking that it can go through the two sides, even though really there's no actual geometric connection. There's only the entanglement of charged matter. Okay? Qualitatively, these two things behave the same. Are there any questions about this point?
So one thing that's a little unclear to me is,
yeah,
how generic is the state that you're starting with here?
Good, good, good. No, I will talk about this in a couple of slides. Yeah, but good. I took a particular state, but indeed, you should ask what happens for more generic states, and I'll get there, yeah. It doesn't work out as nicely, but I think, okay, yeah, I'll get there. Okay. Good. Are there other questions? Yeah. This thing? Not really, actually. So what you want is the fact that the charge, you mean with classical correlations? Or yeah, good. So I don't, you mean if you just had a mixed state that had some classical correlation between the two sides? Yeah, so good. I don't know how to, at the moment, I'm assuming I'm starting in a pure state. If you start in a pure state, you definitely need entanglement between the two sides in a pure quantum state. If you are allowed mixed states, then I think I cannot tell you that this can't happen. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, good. Then it will not work, actually. Because then, let me explain this in a second, actually. So let me get back to your question 1 second. Okay. So the entanglement is tricked to give a thing there's a connection. Okay. So let me just draw this wave function, then I'll get back to your question in a second. Okay. So there is a quantitative difference between these two things. Okay. So what is the quantitative difference between these two things? Well, I computed this Wormhole susceptibility, which is the spread of this wave function, okay, which is 1 over GF squared in the Einstein-Rosen case. It's order 1 in the quantum wormhole case. So the wave function is much, much, much more sharply peaked in this quantum case, okay, versus the classical case. So because these wave functions are so similar, there is a universal difference. The universal behavior is the same, but the details are different in that this susceptibility is much smaller than that. If you apply the same potential difference to a classical wormhole and a quantum wormhole, a much, much smaller E field will go through the quantum wormhole. It's suppressed by powers of this gauge coupling. In the normal classical limit, the gauge coupling has powers of h bar associated with it. So actually, the E field going through a quantum wormhole will be down by powers of h bar. Okay? So it's suppressed by powers of h bar, and you have to work much harder. Okay, so now, Sung-sik, let me come back to your question about the about having discrete numbers of charges. So what I argued is happening in the normal classical wormhole case is that the wave function of the system in the phi sigma and the phi delta space looks like this. Okay? This is what makes it possible. If I have a definite number of charges in each case, then what I'll get is something like this. Phi sigma at some value and phi delta at some other value peaked at a particular specific value, like say 0, 1, 2, blah, blah, blah. So see, there's no spread of phi delta. So if you attach a small mu, what happens here is this whole wave function shifts slightly. And it can shift slightly because it has a spread. Okay? When you apply a small mu to this guy, nothing will happen because it's pinned at this value. It's got a discrete value. You see? What I'm really measuring is the spread of the wave function. That's the important thing here. And to get a spread like of this form in a pure state, you actually need entanglement. The susceptibility is zero. Yeah, you'll have a net. You'll just conclude exactly this. You'll be like, I have 4 particles here, 2 particles there. If you attach a battery, nothing happens. It doesn't look like any E field is going through. Nothing will happen at all. So this is what happens if you have 4 particles there and 3 particles there. Whereas if you want to attach a battery and have a, it's really the tunability of this which is important. That's what I want to call the susceptibility. Susceptibility will be zero, and you can easily tell the difference. Whereas in this case, you can't tell the difference. So that's the key point here. Other questions? Yeah.
So in what step did you use that the particles were entangled?
It's lurking in this whole calculation, actually, because when I traced out this thing here, I got a particular form for the wave for the thermal field state that relied on the fact that they were entangled. Okay, so it's lurking in the background through this whole thing. Okay, and I mean the important point is really this wave function is the crucial thing here. If you think about this wave function, you can easily convince yourself it is not possible to get this wave function in a pure state unless they're quite entangled. Because the fact that this phi sigma is exactly zero means the charge on the left is always anticorrelated with the charge on the right. Okay? And so this wave function here, together with the spread here, actually requires entanglement. So it's fun to convince yourself of this, but I assure you it's true. Okay? So, but it is true that if you allow mixed states, I can't rule. I think you can get the same thing with a mixed state. So if you want, I can comment at the end how you could do more sophisticated measurements to tell between classical and quantum correlations. I think you could actually do this as well, but I haven't done it yet. Good. Other questions? Okay. So where did I conclude? Where did I stop? Okay. So I stopped here. What I said is that there's a spread of the wave function, but it's much, much smaller in the quantum case than in the classical case. Okay. Okay. So what does this mean? If you want to be open-minded, what you might think is this susceptibility is actually measuring the U1 gauge coupling in the wormhole region. That's what this chi delta is doing. It's just a fact. It's equal to 1 over GF squared. If you took this very seriously, what you would then conclude is, in my quantum wormhole, it's like there's a gauge coupling in the wormhole region. It's like the gauge field can propagate there, but the gauge field is very strongly coupled because the coupling looks like it's order 1. So if you were to take this seriously, then there are other things that you can compute, because we have tools to understand how strongly coupled gauge theories behave. So suppose it's true, and in my quantum wormhole, there's a new region of geometry has somehow opened up where the U1 gauge field is very strongly coupled. What could I calculate to probe this? So here's something else. It's an observable that involves the gauge field. Let's imagine passing a Wilson line through both of these things. So first of all, let's pass a Wilson line through the black hole horizon. This is sort of very easy to do. Just imagine this operator, integrate a from the left side to the right side, and raise it to the exponential and compute this Wilson line. So what is this guy? Well, normally, it's actually a very boring calculation because the gauge field is weakly coupled throughout this geometry. And so to leading order, I can just set a to 0. Okay? And this Wilson line is roughly 1 in that it does not really depend on any parameters to leading order. This is really boring. Normally, of course, we expand this in powers, and there are perturbative corrections to this, and we keep those perturbative corrections because they're the first interesting term. I'm not doing that. I'm neglecting those and just setting a to 0 brutally in this wave function, in this Wilson line. Okay? So the Wilson line is roughly 1 between these two sides because the gauge field is weakly coupled everywhere. Now, for the quantum wormhole, it is actually not obvious that I could pass a Wilson line from one side to the other, right? Because there's, again, no geometric connection. But there is an object with the same quantum numbers. So let's imagine taking a Wilson line from this side and moving it to the inside of this guy, inside this box, okay? And now I terminate the Wilson line on a charged scalar field insertion. Now I come to this side and have the opposite scalar field insertion, phi dagger, and then I bring the Wilson line back out. This object is just as gauge invariant as this object. It carries all the same quantum numbers, okay? So I want to call this the Wilson line through the wormhole. What do you get if you compute this? Well, again, you can set these segments. You can set the gauge field A to 0 here and here because the gauge field is weakly coupled inside the two boxes. But you now need to compute this particular mixed correlator across these two sides. This mixed correlator will be 0, will be non-zero only because of the entanglement. And in fact, as you decrease the entanglement between the two sides, this correlator decays exponentially. It's much smaller than in the previous case. So if you wanted to interpret this, what you could say is that as you decrease the entanglement, the gauge field in this wormhole region is fluctuating like crazy. Okay? And because of those crazy fluctuations, it's washing out the Wilson line and decreasing it to 0. Okay? But these are, of course, just words. I'm just wrapping some words around the fact that this particular observable is much smaller in this case than in this case. Okay? But I think qualitatively, you can pass a Wilson line through, and it does what you might expect. Okay, are there any questions about this?
Understand what do you mean by a strongly coupled gluon?
Yeah.
So you have charged matter, or you?
Good. So I mean, there is no. This is at a very crude level. So you can imagine like having a two-side lattice gauge theory, right? And there you can think about the strongly coupled gluon. It's basically at that level. This what I'm saying right here. Okay. Because I mean, there's no continuum description of the wormhole region, right? I can only throw into one end and look at stuff coming out from the other end. So it's kind of like a two-side thing. So when I say strongly coupled U1, I really just mean something like this, in that whatever it was that was measuring the weakness of the coupling here, all those measures are order 1 in this case. That's what I mean by strongly coupled U1. Yeah, and so I think the right way to think about it is the actual things that I have characterizing this is really just a two-side lattice gauge theory. There's a single link between the two sides, and there's a couple of numbers characterizing that link. These are these guys right here. I can't get any finer resolution than that. But of course, that the lattice guy has a tunable number which you can call the coupling. And so that's really what I mean. Yeah.
So that formula on the next slide that you had,
yes.
The result for this correlate, is that the answer that you had, is that the outcome of a calculation? Or is it
yeah, you can calculate this thing. It's just
in the free theory.
In the free theory, yeah. In the free theory, yeah. And then everything's weakly coupled, so there's perturbative corrections, yeah. But yeah. So I mean this is just the yeah, this is because I know the state. It's the Hartle-Hawking. It's that thermofield state. And so you can calculate it exactly. In fact, you can do it. In the easiest way to calculate it is to go to Euclidean. In Euclidean, then it's really you're computing two points that are antipodal points of the Euclidean circle. Okay, that's what this two-sided state is. And so that's why there's a factor of 2 here.
I'm slightly confused. Why do you need strongly coupled?
Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to put some words around this thing. So this computation is in a weakly coupled theory. But I'm saying these answers are vaguely consistent with what you would imagine you would get if you had a strongly coupled gauge theory joining these two sides in the wormhole region. These are just words. Every calculation I do is in a weakly coupled theory. But I'm saying that the answers that you get are sort of what you might expect if you had a narrow region of space between the two sides where the gauge field is very strongly coupled in that region. Okay? You'd get a Wilson line that's non-zero, but it would be very, very small because the gauge would be fluctuating like crazy in there. And so this is I'm saying that maybe the universal physics of this thing you can maybe imagine in that way as a two-site lattice gauge theory with a small coupling. That's all that I'm saying. Okay? Which again is not, I think this should not be a very surprising statement, because a two-site lattice gauge theory has almost no structure. If you just create a couple of numbers that create the data characterizing that link, then that's enough. Okay? So these are just some words I'm wrapping around this calculation. Okay, good. Other questions? Okay. So now, there was a question a little while ago about the genericity of this thing. Okay. So now, the point here is that what I argued is that there's a gauge field maybe in this region that you can think of being strongly coupled. But what you can say is that Gauss's law is exactly satisfied by this state. Okay. If you act with the phi sigma operator on this state, you always find the electric flux into the quantum wormhole equals electric flux out of the quantum wormhole. The wave function of this state looks like this. So why did this happen? This happened because we took a charge pairing of the form like this, always summing minus q with plus q. Okay? That's why we got Gauss's law to exactly be satisfied. So for example, if you were to take a more generic state, okay, if you messed up this correlation of the charges, say, then it would no longer satisfy Gauss's law. Okay? And now I would be comfortable saying that this is no longer anything like a wormhole, because the E field coming into one side is very different from the E field on the other side. Okay? So at first, it looks like there's just no geometric interpretation of this. And this is in agreement with intuition from various other sources that if you take a generic state, you should not be able to interpret it as a wormhole. And I think that this is true. And now we can characterize how much it fails. For example, they won't satisfy Gauss's law. This is a concrete way in which it fails. But now, on the other hand, there is something more that I want to say, which is that we do know of a way to upset Gauss's law in regions of space. If you were to take the wormhole and fill it with a superconducting fluid, the superconductor in the inside is not in a charged eigenstate, and that actually also upsets the correlation of electric field in and electric field out. So for example, I'm not certain there's a big difference between upsetting this correlation here and imagining filling this wormhole with a superconductor. Okay? So if you wanted to give a geometric interpretation to this is, I think, what you would do. Now, I think this is something that can be explored. We can study in detail what happens, how you mess this up, and how the resulting disruption of Gauss's law can be matched to a superconductor. It's something that can actually be studied in detail, but I have not actually done it. Okay? Okay. Good. So this is what happens in more generic states. They don't satisfy Gauss's law, basically. All right. Okay. So let me conclude with some. So this is most of what I had to say. Let me just conclude with some future directions and some things to think about. Okay, so I presented everything in a particular manner by talking about electric fields moving through electric fields and things like this. There's another way to talk about what just happened. And what you can imagine is that these states, these two sides, actually had two independent conserved global charges. And I was studying a particular state that broke down this pattern of symmetries to a diagonal subgroup. This diagonal subgroup you can think about as the one corresponding to the Gauss's law, which is preserved. All right? So I've been studying finite volume systems, and so the symmetry breaking doesn't have tremendously profound, like it has all the consequences that I discussed, but these things are normally more interesting in infinite volume systems, where symmetry breaking of a ground state results in Goldstone modes. Now, I'm of course looking at a very excited state, and the fact that an excited state breaks a symmetry should not be that surprising, because almost all excited states break symmetries, but nonetheless, I kind of think that there should exist Goldstone modes in this setup as well. It's not entirely clear to me what this means in an excited state, but I think it's an interesting way to organize perturbations around this sort of thermofield state. And my reason for thinking this is really coming from holography, not from the calculation that I've described here, but I'm happy to talk about this in more detail. Okay. So next, it seems like it's obviously important. I did everything for E and M, but it seems like the real thing to do is not electromagnetism, but for gravitational fields. Okay. What I argued is that E fields sort of see a wormhole. But really, you care about whether the metric, whether gravitational perturbations see a wormhole. In that case, you could really say that we've created an analog of a wormhole. Now, a very similar story actually applies, because gravitational fields also satisfy a Gauss's law. You know this from Newtonian physics, because the Newtonian potential has a sort of gravitational field that satisfies a Gauss's law. You can do this in GR, and you can go through the same story. All right? So I've only actually done this for a particular, there are now many Gauss's laws, one corresponding to each background isometry of the metric. But you can do the same game. And so, for example, for the component of the metric that corresponds to the energy fluctuations, so to mass, you can do the same thing and compute a different susceptibility. And as you might expect, in the black hole case, it just directly measures the gravitational coupling in the wormhole throat. In the quantum case, you get, again, some sort of order one number, where by order one here, now this has dimensions. And so by order one, I really mean it's set by the dimensions of the problem, okay, like by the mass of the electron or something like that. And so, you know, this, I think this comes a long way towards making, towards saying what you might expect from a Planckian fluctuating Einstein-Rosen bridge, a strongly coupled Planckian wormhole. It really means that the dimensionful parameters characterizing it, which here are Planck's constant, will be much, much, much smaller here. Okay? So I think this is one way to make precise sense of the ideas that were talked about by Susskind and Maldeson. And so we're studying this right now. Okay, but let me summarize. Susskind and Maldeson suggested that we could view the entanglement of perturbative quanta as creating a quantum wormhole. In this talk, I tried to make more precise what you might want a quantum wormhole to do. And one of those things I said was allowing electric field lines to be admitted through it. Because after all, classical wormholes do this. And this is some very basic thing that any caricature of geometry should be able to do. So I argue that classical wormholes emit electric field lines. And then argue that quantum wormholes also emit electric field lines in a precise sense. And I introduced a number to measure how easily this can be done. And I argue that this number is non-zero, and therefore the quantum fluctuations mimic to the electric field, they mimic the effects of the non-trivial topology. And I think this might provide some insight on how geometric structures in general can arise from entanglement. Thank you.